Chapter 80. An unexpected meeting, and a promising prospect, the laws of sympathy between beards and birds, and the secret source of that attraction which frequently impels a shaver of the one to be a dealer in the other, are questions for the subtle reasoning of scientific bodies. Not the less so, because their investigation would seem calculated to lead to no particular result. It is enough to know that the artist who had the honor of entertaining Mrs. Gamp as his first floor lodger united the two pursuits of barbering and bird fancying, and that it was not an original idea of his, but one in which he had, dispersed about the by streets and suburbs of the town, a host of rivals. The name of the householder was Paul Sweetlepipe, but he was commonly called Paul Sweetlepipe, and was not uncommonly believed to have been so christened among his friends and neighbors. With the exception of the staircase and his lodger's private apartment, Paul Sweetlepipe's house was one great bird's nest. Gamecocks resided in the kitchen, pheasants wasted the brightness of their golden plumage on the garret, bantams roosted in the cellar, owls had possession of the bedroom, and specimens of all the smaller fry of birds chirruped and twittered in the shop. The staircase was sacred to rabbits. Therein hutches of all shapes and kinds, made from old packing cases, boxes, drawers, and tea chests, they increased in a prodigious degree, and contributed their share towards that complicated whiff which, quite impartially, and without distinction of persons, saluted every nose that was put into Sweetlepipe's easy shaving shop. Many noses found their way there, for all that, especially on Sunday morning, before church time. Even archbishops shave, or must be shaved, on a Sunday, and beards will grow after 12 o'clock on Saturday night, though it be upon the chins of base mechanics, who, not being able to engage their valets by the quarter, hire them by the job, and pay them, oh, the wickedness of copper coin, in dirty pence. Paul Sweetlepipe, the sinner, shaved all comers at a penny each, and cut the hair of any customer for 2 pence, and being a lone unmarried man, and having some connection in the bird line, Paul got on tolerably well. He was a little elderly man, with a clammy cold right hand, from which even rabbits and birds could not remove the smell of shaving soap. Paul had something of the bird in his nature, not of the hawk or eagle, but of the sparrow, that builds in chimney stacks and inclines to human company. He was not quarrelsome, though, like the sparrow, but peaceful, like the dove. In his walk he strutted, and, in this respect, he bore a faint resemblance to the pigeon, as well as in a certain prosiness of speech, which might, in its monotony, be likened to the cooing of that bird. He was very inquisitive, and when he stood at his shop door in the evening tide, watching the neighbors, with his head on one side, and his eye cocked knowingly, there was a dash of the raven in him. Yet there was no more wickedness in Paul than in a robin. Happily too, when any of his ornithological properties were on the verge of going too far, they were quenched, dissolved, melted down, and neutralized in the barber, just as his bald head otherwise, as the head of a shaved magpie, lost itself in a wig of curly black ringlets, parted on one side, and cut away almost to the crown, to indicate immense capacity of intellect. Paul had a very small, shrill treble voice, which might have led the wags of Kingsgate Street to insist the more upon his feminine designation. He had a tender heart too, for, when he had a good commission to provide 60 sparrows for a shooting match, he would observe, in a compassionate tone, how singular it was that sparrows should have been made expressly for such purposes. The question, whether men were made to shoot them, never entered into Paul's philosophy. Paul wore, in his sporting character, a velveteen coat, a great deal of blue stocking, ankle boots, a neckerchief of some bright color, and a very tall hat. Pursuing his more quiet occupation of barber, he generally subsided into an apron not over clean, a flannel jacket, and corduroy knee shorts. It was in his latter costume, but with his apron girded round his waist, as a token of his having shut up shop for the night, that he closed the door one evening, some weeks after the occurrences detailed in the last chapter, and stood upon the steps in Kingsgate Street, listening until the little cracked bell within should leave off ringing. For until it did, this was Mr. Sweetlepipe's reflection, the place never seemed quiet enough to be left to itself. "It's the greediest little bell to ring," apostrophe said Paul, "that ever was. But it's quiet at last." Apostrophe, he rolled his apron up a little tighter as he said these words, and hastened down the street. Just as he was turning into Holborn, he ran against a young gentleman in a livery. This youth was bold, though small, and with several lively expressions of displeasure, turned upon him instantly. "Now, stupid!" apostrophe apostrophe cried the young gentleman. "Can't you look where you're a-going to, eh? Can't you mind where you're a-coming to, eh? What do you think your eyes was made for, eh? Ah! Yes! Oh! Now then!" Apostrophe apostrophe, the young gentleman pronounced the two last words in a very loud tone, and with frightful emphasis, as though they contained within themselves the essence of the direst aggravation. But he had scarcely done so, when his anger yielded to surprise, and he cried, in a milder tone, "What? Polly? Apostrophe, why, it and you, sure!" Apostrophe apostrophe cried Paul. "It can't be you." Apostrophe, "No. It and me," apostrophe returned the youth. "It's my son, my oldest one. He's a credit to his father, and he, Polly?" Apostrophe with this delicate little piece of banter, he halted on the pavement, and went round and round in circles, for the better exhibition of his figure, rather to the inconvenience of the passengers generally, who were not in an equal state of spirits with himself. "I wouldn't have believed it," apostrophe said Paul. "What? You've left your old place, then? Have you?" Apostrophe, "Have I?" Apostrophe apostrophe returned his young friend, who had by this time stuck his hands into the pockets of his white cord breeches, and was swaggering along at the barber's side. "Do you know a pair of top boots when you see 'em, Polly? Look here." Apostrophe, "Beautiful," cried Mr. Sweetlepipe. "Do you know a slap-up sort of button when you see it?" Apostrophe apostrophe said the youth. "Don't look at mine, if you ain't a judge, because these lions' heads was made for men of taste, not snobs." Apostrophe, "Beautiful." Apostrophe apostrophe cried the barber again. "A grass-green frock coat too, bound with gold, and a cockade in your hat." Apostrophe apostrophe, "I should hope so," apostrophe replied the youth. "Blow the cockade, though. For, except that it don't turn round, it's like a ventilator that used to be in the kitchen winder at Todgers. You ain't seen the old lady's name in the Gazette, have you?" Apostrophe apostrophe, "No," apostrophe returned the barber. "Is she a bankrupt?" Apostrophe, "If she ain't, she will be," apostrophe retorted Bailey. "That business never can be carried on without me. Well, how are you?" Apostrophe, "Oh, I'm pretty well," apostrophe said Paul. "Are you living at this end of the town, or were you coming to see me? Was that the business that brought you to Holborn?" Apostrophe apostrophe, "I haven't got no business in Holborn," apostrophe returned Bailey, with some displeasure. "All my business lays at the West End. I've got the right sort of governor now. You can't see his face for his whiskers, and can't see his whiskers for the dye upon them. That's a gentleman, ain't it? You wouldn't like a ride in a cab, would you? Why, it wouldn't be safe to offer it. You'd faint away, only to see me a-comin' at a mild trot round the corner." Apostrophe, to convey a slight idea of the effect of this approach, Mr. Bailey counterfeited in his own person the action of a high-trotting horse, and threw up his head so high, in backing against a pump, that he shook his hat off. "Why, he's own uncle to Capricorn," apostrophe said Bailey, "and brother to Cauliflower. He's been through the winders of two Cheney shops since we've had him, and was sold for killing his missus. That's a horse, I hope. Apostrophe apostrophe ah. You will never want to buy any more red poles now, apostrophe observed Pole, looking on his young friend with an air of melancholy. You will never want to buy any more red poles now, to hang up over the sink, will you? Apostrophe apostrophe, I should think not, apostrophe replied Bailey. Reetherzo. I wouldn't have nothing to say to any bird below a peacock, and he'd be welger. Well, how are you? Apostrophe apostrophe, oh. I'm pretty well, apostrophe said Paul. He answered the question again, because Mr. Bailey asked it again. Mr. Bailey asked it again, because accompanied with a straddling action of the white cords, a bend of the knees, and a striking forth of the top boots, it was an easy horse fleshy, turfy sort of thing to do. What are you up to, old feller? Apostrophe apostrophe added Mr. Bailey, with the same graceful rakishness. He was quite the man about town of the conversation, while the easy shaver was the child. Why, I am going to fetch my lodger home, apostrophe said Paul. A woman! Apostrophe apostrophe cried Mr. Bailey, for a 20-pun note. Apostrophe, the little barber hastened to explain, that she was neither a young woman, nor a handsome woman, but a nurse, who had been acting as a kind of housekeeper to a gentleman for some weeks past, and left her place that night, in consequence of being superseded by another, and a more legitimate housekeeper, to wit, the gentleman's bride. He's newly married, and he brings his young wife home tonight, apostrophe said the barber. So I'm going to fetch my lodger away, Mr. Chuzzlewit's, close behind the post office, and carry her box for her. Apostrophe, Jonas Chuzzlewit's? Apostrophe, apostrophe said Bailey. Ah! Apostrophe, apostrophe returned Paul. That's the name sure enough. Do you know him? Apostrophe, apostrophe, oh, no! Apostrophe, apostrophe cried Mr. Bailey. Not at all. And I don't know her. Not neither. Why, they first kept company through me, Amist. Apostrophe, ah? Apostrophe, apostrophe said Paul. Ah. Apostrophe, apostrophe said Mr. Bailey, with a wink. And she ain't bad looking, mind you. But her sister was the best. She was the merry one. I often used to have a bit of fun with her, in the old times. Apostrophe apostrophe, Mr. Bailey spoke, as if he already had a leg, and three quarters in the grave, and this had happened 20 or 30 years ago. Paul Sweetlepipe, the meek, was so perfectly confounded by his precocious self-possession, and his patronizing manner, as well as by his boots, cockade, and livery, that a mist swam before his eyes, and he saw not the Bailey of acknowledged juvenility from Todger's commercial boarding house, who had made his acquaintance within a 12-month, by purchasing, at sundry times, small birds at 2d each, but a highly condensed embodiment of all the sporting grooms in London, an abstract of all the stable knowledge of the time. A something at a high pressure that must have had existence many years, and was fraught with terrible experiences. And truly, though in the cloudy atmosphere of Todgers, Mr. Bailey's genius had ever shone out brightly in this particular respect, it now eclipsed both time and space, cheated beholders of their senses, and worked on their belief in defiance of all natural laws. He walked along the tangible and real stones of Holborn Hill, an undersized boy, and yet he winked the winks, and thought the thoughts, and did the deeds, and said the sayings of an ancient man. There was an old principle within him, and a young surface without. He became an inexplicable creature, a breeched and booted sphinx. There was no course open to the barber, but to go distracted himself, or to take Bailey for granted. And he wisely chose the latter. Mr. Bailey was good enough to continue to bear him company, and to entertain him, as they went, with easy conversation on various sporting topics, especially on the comparative merits, as a general principle, of horses with white stockings, and horses without. In regard to the style of tail to be preferred, Mr. Bailey had opinions of his own, which he explained, but begged they might by no means influence his friends, as here he knew he had the misfortune to differ from some excellent authorities. He treated Mr. Sweetlepipe to a dram, compounded agreeably to his own directions, which he informed him had been invented by a member of the Jockey Club, and, as they were by this time near the barber's destination, he observed that, as he had an hour to spare, and knew the parties, he would, if quite agreeable, be introduced to Mrs. Gamp. Paul knocked at Jonas Chuzzlewit's, and, on the door, being opened by that lady, made the two distinguished persons known to one another. It was a happy feature in Mrs. Gamp's twofold profession, that it gave her an interest in everything that was young as well as in everything that was old. She received Mr. Bailey with much kindness. "It's very good, I'm sure, of you to come," apostrophe she said to her landlord, "as well as bring so nice a friend. But I'm afraid that I must trouble you so far as to step in, for the young couple has not yet made appearance. Apostrophe, they're late, ain't they?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, inquired her landlord, when she had conducted them downstairs into the kitchen. "Well, sir, considering the wings of love, they are," apostrophe said Mrs. Gamp. Mr. Bailey inquired whether the wings of love had ever won a plate, or could be backed to do anything remarkable, and being informed that it was not a horse, but merely a poetical or figurative expression, evinced considerable disgust. Mrs. Gamp was so very much astonished by his affable manners and great ease, that she was about to propound to her landlord in a whisper the staggering inquiry, whether he was a man or a boy, when Mr. Sweetlepipe, anticipating her design, made a timely diversion. "He knows Mrs. Chuzzlewit," apostrophe said Paul aloud. "There's nothing he don't know, that's my opinion," apostrophe observed Mrs. Gamp. "All the wickedness of the world is print to him." Apostrophe, Mr. Bailey received this as a compliment, and said, adjusting his cravat, "Reether so. Apostrophe, as you knows Mrs. Chuzzlewit, you knows, p'raps, what her christen name is." Apostrophe, apostrophe, Mrs. Gamp observed. "Charity," apostrophe said Bailey. "That it ain't." Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried Mrs. Gamp. "Cherry, then," apostrophe said Bailey. "Cherry's short for it. It's all the same. Apostrophe, it don't begin with a C at all," apostrophe retorted Mrs. Gamp, shaking her head. "It begins with a M apostrophe, whew." Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried Mr. Bailey, slapping a little cloud of pipe clay out of his left leg. "Then he's been, and married the merry one." Apostrophe, apostrophe, as these words were mysterious, Mrs. Gamp called upon him to explain. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.